Today on Rockin' the Suburbs.
You know, Patrick, I've been thinking a lot about great years in music, and I was then thinking maybe we should have listeners call and give us their thoughts.
Oh, yeah, that sounds good.
So, call 612-440-1984. We are at the end of the year.
Yes, we are.
If all my plans go correctly and this episode airs where I think it will, this should be like just getting under the wire for 2019. Mm-hmm. And that's important for today's topic because today is a patron show.
All right.
So patrons of Rockin' the Suburbs, they if they contribute at a certain level, they get to come on the show every so often and pick a topic they want to talk about. And just as an aside, the way you can do that is go to patreon.com/suburbspod and all the information is there. Mm-hmm. But today on Rockin' the Suburbs, and my name is Jim Linehan.
And I'm Patrick Foster.
Today we have patron Mike Coley. Hello, Mike.
Hello, guys.
And Mike, where are you?
I live in Rome, New York. It's right smack dab in the middle of New York State in the snow belt.
Yep. And I understand you have a lot of snow right now.
Yeah. It's piling up.
How far are you from Buffalo, Mike?
We're about 3 hours east of Buffalo.
Okay. So would Buffalo be your default NFL team if you follow that sport?
I'm a Bills fan, but as far as television coverage goes, we're kind of in a gray zone.
Okay.
We're right in the middle of the Jets-Giants zone, Bills zone. So some Jets games on CBS, sometimes we get the Bills games. Most of the time we get the Bills games, but we do get Jets games every once in a while.
Well, this is a good Bills year. And yeah. I only bring that up because I went to the Pro Football Hall of Fame last month, and it really was a great thing. And I got to tell you, it was so cool because if you're a Bills fan or you're from Buffalo, you get a 10% discount on admission just because their fans are so passionate, apparently, over the years. Two sets of fans. So if you can say, like, I'm a Browns fan, because obviously you're in Ohio, or you're a Bills fan, you get a 10% discount on admission. Yeah.
Okay.
I guess Buffalo is not that far from Cleveland.
Right.
You know,
right.
Canton, yep. I guess, is where that is. But it's not that far away. So it's probably the next, I guess, Pittsburgh would be the next closest, and then Buffalo will be after that.
And Bills fans obviously have an intense passion for their team. If you've ever seen their tailgating, where people dive off the back of RVs onto, like, tables and stuff. Yeah, that's great. But anyway, that's not why Mike called.
No, that's not at all. let me get back to where I started this. The year 2019. We're in the year 2019.
That's right. End of the decade as well.
And this has special significance for the topic. Why, Mike?
Because 35 years ago is the year I'd like to talk about, 1984.
Okay.
Okay.
As being a pivotal moment in the formation of what would later become alternative rock.
How so?
You see a lot of a lot of labels sprouting up throughout the country, regional labels that kind of focused on areas that weren't typically included on the big tour itineraries of the bands of the day. So you'll see. I mean, SST is based in LA, but they had their own little focus. With bands that they kind of lean punk, you know, with Greg Ginn starting the label and being in Black Flag. But you also had bands like Minutemen who were punk, but they also dabbled in free jazz style and spoken word style and all different styles of music that, while not necessarily punk in the classic definition of the sound of punk, it was punk just because it just went all over the place.
A richer understanding of what's already understood. No meanings from the here and now.
Yep, I agree, Mike. I think that's really well said, and kind of like we touched on in the hardcore episode when we talked about the big umbrella of punk. That definitely was part of it, right?
That, oh, absolutely.
Yeah, that the Minutemen, for one example, and I'm sure there are many more. You know, made it cool, made it okay, I guess, to like all those different kinds of, you know, styles of music just because it was good. And that was a real, for me personally, that meant a lot, that, you know, they kind of broke that wall down.
Yeah, and when you think about the different labels that were sprouting up all over the country, like Sub Pop was just starting to originate in Seattle area. That was an area that bands didn't typically hit, you know, the big arena tours. They didn't typically hit, so they kind of created their own scene. And they created their own sound, and they created their own community just based around what they were doing there. And then labels started sprouting up to get that music out to a bigger audience. Same thing with, like, Twin Tone in Minneapolis, where the Replacements and Soul Asylum were doing their stuff. And, you know, they're kind of off the tour map. So they created their own sound, their own thing there.
So what were you doing in 1984?
In 1984, I was in ninth grade. So I was in ninth grade. I was in junior high here. And I was just starting to get into... I was kind of a metal kid starting out. You know, Kiss was my first love. But then I started getting into The Who. But then I also started getting into metal at the same time. So I was into Judas Priest, Iron Maiden. Then when the Megaforce label started putting out, you know, Metallica and Anthrax and Overkill, and I got deep into the thrash scene of the early to mid 80s. And so that's kind of where my background was back then. And it's still kind of stuck with me. I mean, when you're 13, 14 years old, I think that's when you really start to form your own music identity. And the stuff that you discover at that time just kind of sticks with you for a long, long time.
Oh, for sure.
Totally, man. And I will say this really quickly, Jim and Mike, that, you know, 84 for me, I was working in a record store, so I was very attuned to the commerciality of that year, and it was a big year for commercial records. I mean, you had Prince, Madonna, Michael Jackson, like all these people. So it definitely did, you know, provide an environment where you did need to create kind of an underground reaction and structure to that massive commercial machine that was like dominating, right?
So you kind of beat me to something here, which is I was going to talk about the commercial success of 1984, the year before or after Mike was talking about some of the alternative records. But let me just run down for you right now some of the albums that came out in 1984. First of all, you had the album 1984. That was one. You had Born in the USA.
Yeah.
Purple Rain.
That sold a few copies.
Like a Virgin.
That's right.
Heartbeat City.
Yeah.
Right?
By the Cars.
You know, there were like two Smiths albums released that year when we get into the alternative stuff. There was a Metallica album.
Mm-hmm. Footloose. Yeah,
there was a lot of big... Oh, the Wham! Make It Big came out that year.
Oh, my God. That was a big record, too.
It was a big year for music. I mean, if you just took the Springsteen, Prince, and Madonna records alone right there. That's a pretty enormous year.
Yeah. Cindy Lauper had a pretty big album that year too. Yeah, it was.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Those some of those albums, because I grew up around Syracuse, I still live around Syracuse, and the Carrier Dome used to have just monster concerts back then.
Yeah.
And Springsteen played at the Carrier Dome, Prince played at the Carrier Dome, all in that same time frame. I believe Van Halen did too. That time frame. So yeah, those artists had a huge presence when I was in high school, junior high, and high school.
It was really big. It really felt like music was as big as anything.
Yeah.
At that time period, don't
Without
you think?
Without a doubt.
Yeah.
Without a doubt.
Hang on one second. I got to take care of one little bit of business here. That was a Devil's Backbone Vienna Lager that I just opened. Yeah. Okay, so let me just run down. Mike sent a list of some important songs to him in 1984. Okay. So why don't we just run down that list? We'll hear a little bit of each one, and then we can discuss it.
Great.
Okay?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so the first one Mike here sent was Never Talking to You Again by Husker Du from Zen Arcade.
There are things that I'd like to say, but I'm never talking to you again. There's things I'd like to pray somewhere, but I'm never talking to you again. I'm never talking to you again. I'm never talking to you. I'm tired of wasting all my time trying to talk to you. I put you down where you belong, but I'm never talking to you again. I show you everywhere you're wrong, but I'm never talking to you again. I'm never talking to you again. I'm never talking to you. I'm tired of wasting all my time trying to talk to you. Talking to you.
Okay. What is important about that song to you, Mike?
I came into Husker Du a little bit late in the game, more on their final album, Warehouse album, when I was a senior in high school. And so I kind of backtracked. But when I being a subscriber to Spin and Rolling Stone and seeing these albums show up in their year-end lists over the years, Zen Arcade kept popping up. So once I started digging into that, this song, it's got a punk drive to it, but it's got the acoustic guitar feel to it, and just the acoustic sound of it, the rhythm of the acoustic guitar is what draws me in, and then the melodic vocals, and what's supposed to be a kind of hardcore punk album, is just what that's my favorite song from that album, just because of that. It goes against what the punk ethos, quote unquote, is supposed to be, and Husker Du just was doing what they wanted to do, and that's what they did their whole career.
So that was a Grant Hart composition,
yep.
And you can tell, I think, from it, right?
Yep.
Don't you think?
Totally,
it's a little bit sweeter, I think, yep, than some of the stuff Bob wrote.
Right. Well, and I think Mike hit it on the head, especially going back to what he just said about that song, but also what he said at the top, that it was a time in which it was okay to embrace suddenly all these different elements. So you would originally think to yourself, wait, an acoustic guitar on a Husker Du record? No way. Like, that's ridiculous. These guys have sold out. The way they made that work was really instrumental in part of that expanding. I don't know. It was a time when your mind was expanding, thinking about what's possible with punk music. Like, if I take the cool stuff I love, or, like Mike said, if I take the cool hard rock of Kiss and I put it together with, some elements from The Who and The Clash, and then suddenly I've got this really amazing music and I just play it all faster. So that's kind of what I think about, just mind-expanding albums, both Zen Arcade and I think the Minutemen record, Double Nickels, that we'll talk about too.
Oh, yeah, for sure. Well, that's the next song that Mike had down here, which is History Lesson Part 2, Minutemen.
Our band could be your life. Real names be proved. Me and Mike Watt, we played for years. Punk rock changed our lives. We learned punk rock in Hollywood. Drove up from Pedro. We were f***ing corn dogs. We'd go drink and pogo. Mr. Narrator, this is Bob Dylan to me. My story could be his songs. I'm his soldier child.
But I love the fact that album, in the Minutemen's liner notes for that album, they wrote, "Take that, Husker Du."
Yeah.
It's kind of a response because they're both double albums, which in the punk realm, that's unheard of.
Right.
You think of it, that's more overblown prog rock stuff from the 70s that they were supposedly raging against, but here they are putting together concept albums or double albums, and supposedly a punk band. You know, and you know, I don't know if they really necessarily considered themselves punk as just rock and roll bands, but they had a punk attitude to them, and that's what really draws me to both of these bands, especially.
Yeah, man, that's really well said, and you know, I think Mike Watt and D. Boone never denied the fact that, you know, they first concerts, you know, they ever went to was like Blue Oyster Cult, and they got into those bands, you know, because they liked the raw guitar sound of those bands, and those definitely were inspirations for them, and maybe that's part of it too. I mean, what do you think, Mike? It's like part of it is just not, you know, disowning or disavowing any of the bands you liked, even if it was Kiss. Like, you didn't have to hide that anymore, right? You could openly tell people, yeah, I like Kiss, I've always liked him, or I like Metallica, you know? I mean, that, I think that's a big part of it.
Oh, absolutely, because, yeah, I mean, on this album, they covered Steely Dan's Dr.
Yes,
Who.
That's right. Yeah.
Steely Dan, that is the complete antithesis of a punk band.
It really is.
And this shiny studio band, and you got the Minutemen saying, hey, we like these guys. We're going to cover that song on our Opus double album. So, yeah, definitely.
Well,
with the Husker Du covering 8 Miles High by the Byrds, they're still looking back on what was before them and still giving them some reverence, despite the fact that they're raging out on occasion, you know?
They also say, Mr. Narrator, this is Bob Dylan to me. My story could be his songs. Yeah.
I mean, think about the lyrics to this song, right? I mean, the first line became sort of a book, you know, the title of a book that sort of documented part of this era anyway,
right,
or part of this era. And, you know, some of the stuff, man, we learned punk rock in Hollywood. We drove up from Pedro. I mean, you can't imagine how funny that actually was at the time. I mean, and yet there he is, you know, naming off his influences, like Joe Hell and Richard Strummer are all in the lyrics. So it's pretty amazing. Yeah.
You meant Richard Hell and Joe Strummer.
Hell and Joe Strummer. What did I say?
I think you had it reversed.
Yeah.
Anyway.
I got excited.
And John Doe.
And John Doe. Yeah.
Yeah. Incredible song. It's a great song.
Yeah.
Okay. And then the next one you had was, Metallica. I mentioned Metallica had an album that year, For Whom the Bell Tolls from Ride the Lightning.
I was in study hall. A buddy of mine had one of those metal fanzines, and there was just an ad in the back of the fanzine for Megaforce Records that had just a slew of bands that I had never heard of, never even knew existed. It was like it just opened up a whole new world of music just from an ad in a fanzine. And it was Metallica and Merciful Fate and Anthrax and Overkill and Testament and just that whole thrash scene from the early to mid 90s, that all of a sudden I'm drawing their logos on my notebooks and during study hall I'm creating these stories where the members of these bands are like comic book heroes in these stories, and you got Rob Halford dueling with Scott Ian in a battle of forces between the old school and the new school. And I wish I still had those notebooks, because those were pretty
me too.
But yeah, I mean, it opened up a whole new world to me. And then I used to listen to a syndicated show, Metal Shop. Charlie Kendall used to host back in the 80s. And and I first heard Ride the Lightning and For Whom the Bell Tolls on that show. I recorded it on my little Maxell XL2 tapes and walked down to the park to meet my buddies to play some hoops. And was like, you guys got to hear this band. These guys are amazing. And so, you know, it was, Metallica opened up so many musical doors for me. And just that whole Megaforce Records label. But it also, you know, as it went forward, I mean, Metallica became one of the biggest bands in the world. And back then, there was no way in hell I was thinking that Metallica would ever be played on mainstream radio.
Oh, you know, right.
From something like Metal Shop, but... You know, now you hear them at stadiums during timeouts, and it still blows my mind.
Totally incredible. And, you know, I remember listening to some of those bands that you mentioned, especially Overkill was a band, you know, that I had not really heard, and listened to those guys. Anthrax, another one where you're like, wow, these guys actually sound like a lot like punk, you know, and that was pretty cool. To actually get that kind of sense. But again, you know, it really was a time where you're like, I need to open my mind not only to maybe the possibility that there could be an acoustic guitar and acoustic or do record, but also the fact that I could like metal, you know, and that's something that's great. It really was, I don't know, all these records to me so far have that theme of just being proud of what you actually like and sticking with it. And like you said, Mike, at that time in your life, man, how important is that? Like, what a lucky time to really be a music fan, you know, and to like really have your mind expanded. That's pretty great.
Yeah, and I always felt, you know, because my big group of friends back then, they were strictly metal, and for me to say that I liked the Who, I was seen as kind of the dork of the group because I had Pete Townsend in my locker door and a Who painter's hat with buttons on, well, hanging out with the metal dudes with the long hair, but you know, as time wore on, I mean, everybody kind of started liking many different styles of music. So we all I'm still friends with a lot of those guys too. We talk music all the time, and they've kind of come my way as far as like with my liking of the Who.
Okay, so then there was one more song that you listed here, Mike, which is a cover song. So you want to talk about that one?
Yeah. As I mentioned earlier, Kiss was like the first band that I really got into as a kid. And you know, people my age, if you weren't exposed to Kiss, then you must have been sleeping, because they had, you know, the lunch boxes and the action figures and the trading cards and that god-awful television show, Kiss Meets the Phantom of the Park.
No gratitude need be voiced. Your mind speaks to us. You're looking for someone, but it's not Kiss.
And you know, me and my group of friends, our lives revolved around Kiss when we were 8, 9, 10, 11 years old. And we would go in my garage and pretend we were Kiss. You know, we'd use an old stove in the garage as the drum set, and tennis brackets and baseball bats and wiffle bats as guitars and microphone stands. And we would pretend we were Kiss in the garage, putting Kiss Alive 2 album on the record player in the garage. And so one of my favorite songs from Kiss is Black Diamond. And the Replacements decided to cover Black Diamond on Let It Be, their Let It Be album. And that totally shocked me big time when I first started getting into the Replacements. Because again, I came into the Replacements a little bit late too. I backtracked from Don't Tell a Soul when that came out is when I really got into them, and then I went backwards. And hearing them do Black Diamond, and you don't know if it was a tongue-in-cheek cover or if they truly were showing reverence just by, you know, first listening to it. But I listened to the crap out of that song when I first heard the Replacements doing it.
say this. I mean, you know, definitely hindsight helps, but I always thought, man, you don't do a tongue-in-cheek or like a, you know, a sort of funny Kiss cover if you choose Black Diamond. Like, you have to be a real Kiss fan to do that. And, you know, we know now from reading and everything that Bob Stinson was a really big Kiss fan, and Paul probably too. All those guys listened to it. So that to me was like, yeah, this is another example of just really liking something and liking it so much that we're actually going to cover it, you know? And I always thought that was so great.
Okay. So those are all amazing songs from 1984.
Totally.
And is there anything that you can think of from that year that you'd like to talk about?
Well,
or meant something to you?
I mean, I think we should talk about Yamo Be There. It was obviously a pretty big song from that year with James Ingram and Michael McDonald. No, I'm just kidding.
I was like, where is this going? All right.
I don't know, Jim. What about you? Do you have
All right,
any,
let me
any,
let me give you
yeah.
one. But of course, R.E.M. Reckoning came out that year.
Yep.
But I didn't get into R.E.M. until the next album. So I'm not going to count that one for my pick.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mentioned a lot of the big albums that came out, and you can't deny Purple Rain. I mean, that's
no.
To me, that would probably be the best album of that
right.
year.
Right.
But I'm going to give you one that I think was kind of important to me, at least in hindsight, which is The Pretenders Learning to Crawl.
Ah, great call, man. Yeah.
That came out in that came out in January of 1984,
yep.
and it actually included Back on the Chain Gang, which was released a single like a year and a half before.
Yeah, that's
you
right.
You know, it was
yeah.
a weird thing.
Mm-hmm.
They had two band members die from drug overdoses. It was really sad.
Yeah.
So it kind of took a while, I think, to get this album out with a new personnel. Then when they were really promoting the record, there was the single Middle of the Road, which I think is just an incredible song.
Yep.
But let's listen to one that's maybe a deeper cut.
Okay.
That I really like. It's called Time the Avenger. I wanted to showcase this album was because when I was in high school in 1984, I would have been at this point, January of 84 would have been my junior year.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, I wasn't really into alternative music. I kind of got that more when I went to college. But I would say, you know, I got into the Pretenders from this album, and I would consider that sort of alternative adjacent.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, exactly.
And so to me, this was, I think, kind of along that, you know, it's kind of a stepping stone
yeah.
or, you know, a bridge to where I was yeah. heading, I think, with my musical taste, right?
Totally, totally. I think that's a great way to put it, alternative, sort of like right there, because obviously Chrissie Hynde was there in London, you know, in the 70s writing and kind of absorbing that whole scene and took that whole punk spirit into that record. That's a really good call. That's a record I haven't listened to in a long time, but it's really, really
good. It's fantastic.
Oh, yeah, it's great.
It has such incredible energy
Man.
To it. And then there's some soul in it, too. They do a cover of Thin Line Between Love and Hate,
right.
and that also has the My City Was Gone.
Yes, that's a fantastic song.
And, you know, which was interesting, too, because of, you know, growing up in Ohio, and then she's singing about, you know, her experiences with
right.
Akron, was it? Is that where she was
yeah,
from?
Yeah, I think so. And wow, that's a really good call. I hadn't thought about that. And, you know, I think for me, besides all those pop hits we were talking about, I mean, the album that sticks in my mind is another SST record. I mean, Meat Puppets 2 came out that year, and that, I mean, you could pretty much pick any song off that record, you know, that would be a Stone Cold classic. But talk about a band that mixed suddenly country and psychedelia into punk, and they would, you know, get up there, right, and play on those Black Flag bills and those SST package tours and play that country music. They would play Tumbling Tumbleweeds and all these covers, you know, to those people. So, I mean, the song to me that kind of merges punk and metal and all the kind of influences is Lake of Fire on Meat Puppets 2. And to me, that's like a Stone Cold classic.
An interesting SST, man. They had a year in 1984.
Wow, it really was a groundbreaking
year. Zen Arcade, yep. Double Nickels on the Dime, yeah. And Meat Puppets 2. I mean, some people, fans of those bands, might argue those are their best records.
Yep.
Right?
You could make a very good argument that that would be it. And, you know, the label had a problem even because suddenly they were flushed with this critical success. I mean, I remember reading about Meat Puppets 2 in Rolling Stone magazine and going out and buying it because of that. But, you know, they couldn't keep them in print. That was one of the problems they had. The Meat Puppets album was successful, but the Minutemen and Husker Du were both double vinyl, and they were running on a shoestring. They had to try to print enough of all these records in 84 and get them into those small towns that they would go and play, like Mike was talking about. You know, how do we get, you know, a copy of this record up to Portland or, you know, or Olympia or wherever we're playing, like every small town. So,
any thoughts on any of that, Mike?
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of where I that was my jumping off point, really, was SST, because I seemed to just gravitate towards everything on that label, and it was like a kitchen sink label that, you know, it was kind of under the punk umbrella, like you guys talked about during Hardcore Week, that big large umbrella of music. But you had, you know, Sonic Youth was on that label, Soundgarden was on that label, St. Vitus was on that label, Firehose, Dinosaur Jr., Screaming Trees, Bad Brains put an album out on that label.
They did.
It was just all over the place, yet it still fit. And they were all relevant bands that influenced so many bands down the road. That I think SST, just in that aspect alone, I mean, you know, so many of the other regional labels had a huge part in it too, but SST, they were kind of the groundbreakers as far as that goes, I think.
Totally. And I mean, this could be a whole nother podcast, but you could definitely argue that Black Flag was the one that established all those little towns that no one went to, and Des Moines and you know, all those college towns that they played, and that fed into the rise of college radio. And I don't know, Mike, this might be a series. Yeah. your next couple calls, we might have to explore this deeper, because you really hit a vein on this one, man.
That book Rollins wrote, Get in the Van.
Yeah, exactly.
About their networking all across the country.
Yeah.
People's floors and hooking up with other bands all across the country, you know. And,
yeah. Right. Waiting for people to, like, get up in the Denny's so they could grab the rest of their meal so they can actually have something to eat.
Well, thank you very much, Mike, for bringing this topic to our attention.
Fantastic.
The year 1984, if anyone else would like to comment on what records came out that year that were important to you, we'd love to hear it. So you can call and leave a message,
612-440-1984,
or email rock@suburbspod.com, or find us on the social medias, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, all those at Suburbs Pod. And again, if you'd like to be on the show like Mike and pick the topic, find that information at Patreon, Patreon.com slash suburbs pod. It's perfect. All right there. We would love to have you. All right. I got to go rescue my wife. we have some other guests who came in the house, and the dog apparently is attacking them. So I got to help her out with that. So thanks again, Mike Coley. We really appreciate it.
Thank you, Mike. It's always great to talk to you, man.
And pretty soon, it'll be so snowy, you're going to have to get up and shovel the roof, right?
That's right.
Isn't that happening up there?
Yeah, that does happen here. There's actual cottage industry of roof shovelers.
Isn't that crazy?
That's a good name for a band, too, the Roof Shovelers.
Yeah, that would be good. All right, well, we so appreciate it. Thanks very much, man.
Thanks for your support, Mike.
Thanks a lot, guys.
It's Rockin' the Suburbs. I'm Jim Linehan.
I'm Patrick Foster.
And with us, of course, was Mike Coley, and we'll talk to you guys later.
Heavy words are so lightly thrown, but still I leap in front of a flying bullet for you. So what difference does it make? So what difference does it make? It makes none, but now you have gone, and you must be looking very old tonight. We'll find work for idle hands to do. I stole and I lied, and why? Because you asked me to. But now you make me feel so ashamed, because I've only got two hands, but I'm still fond of you. Oh, oh, oh. So what difference does it make?
Like Joe Hell and Richard Strummer.